So again, welcome everyone to this day of mindfulness. Express the gratitude on for all of us, to those who helped organize this day of mindfulness, publicizing it and setting it up, physical meditation hall and the other things for lunch and all that, so gratitude. Some of you might have noticed we had a little bit of a medical emergency this morning, which I thought was a very real-life opportunity for us to really watch our minds and watch our reactivity. I want to say thank you to the, to the people, especially the medical professionals. We happen to have some here who kind of knew what to do, stepped right in, took care of business. It's good to have people around who know what they're doing. We're going to be reading from Shanti Deva today, and those of you who know, we've been involved in our community looking at this very well-known, beloved, deeply respected text of this 8th century Indian master, Buddhist master, Shanti Deva, and the text is called The Way of the Bodhisattva, the Enlightened Being. And somewhere in there, it's all poetry, it's verses, he says in relationship to situations that may come up in life, he says very simply, if there is something that can be done, helpful, do it. If there's nothing could be done, just relax. Be okay. Many of us, unfortunately, live in a kind of state of hyper arousal, where any little kind of upsetting thing within our own body, mind, or in anybody else's or in the world, immediately calls forth an emotional or a mental, sometimes a physical reaction. So we're always keeping ourselves, especially these days where so much access to news 24/7, we can keep ourselves always in a state of reactivity, emotional reactivity, upset mind, but there's really nothing we can do. So we're endlessly cultivating this afflictive mind without any discharge. And there's really no reason for it. Again, this morning was quite wonderful. I mean the gentleman is fine, by the way. He just seemed to have passed out for whatever reason, but he was fine and cogent and everything is good. Can be checked. He was checked out and will be checked out. Simply what happened this morning? Something happened, right? Something happened. Most of us in the immediacy of something happened, we didn't know what happened, did we? So we turn and what? We look. We see what? Someone has fallen off their chair. Do we know why? Not a clue. And then we see, and there were some announcements, that we have medical professionals, fortunately, who are here today, and they immediately went over and what? Took charge. How wonderful. Now the rest of us, what did we do? Did we stay present within ourselves, aware, mindful, relaxed, alert? Or did our minds immediately begin to get agitated? And did we have to look? Many of us have had the experience, I'm sure, on 75 or other places where there's these massive traffic jams, right? And you finally get up to where it is, you think there's maybe some accident has blocked the road. And oftentimes something has happened off the road, right? And everybody is doing what? In both directions. Stopping and looking. Right? You might call that voyeurism. You always have to stop and look. You always have to watch the news. And the news is endlessly giving us what? Not only big problems in the world, things that are going on, but in our own community, right? Somebody got shot here. Somebody got beaten up over here. And so, you know what I mean? It's like endlessly, and we're like voyeurs, you know. And all it does is feed what? What? Fear. Fear. So again, I think this was very good for us this morning to experience that. You know, Thich Nhat Hanh writing about situations like this. He talked about the boat people. You know, there was a time in the 70s, getting older, 70s, when we know there was a kind of a massive outflux of people from Vietnam. And they were, most of them, you know, had to leave in boats. They're called the boat people. And they had to make a difficult crossing across the sea. And along the way, you know, all kinds of difficulties, not only difficulties of the sea, food, water, but there were pirates who came from Thailand who were often preyed on them. You know, storms come up. So Thich Nhat Hanh wrote, he said, talking specifically about the boat people, he said, when there is a difficulty, a difficult situation, most people what? Panic. Panic. Fear. Anxiety. Act out. Which only clouds the mind. So what he said was somebody, at least one person, has to make the commitment to remain what? Calm, clear, stable. So one can really see the situation clearly, see possibilities of dealing with it, and respond from that clear, intelligent place. He said, you know, and he basically, he was using that as an analogy to say, in this world, those of us who practice this path, we have a responsibility when everybody else is losing their head and running around in fear and anger and despair, somebody's got to stay clear, stable, to really seek what's going on, to look deeply into the situation. Right? That's our responsibility. You know, Thich Nhat Hanh is also famous for turning, you know, the turning on its head that expression that, you know, many of us heard growing up, you know, don't just stand there, do something. Everybody heard that? And Thich Nhat Hanh went, no. He said, don't just do something, stand there. I mean, it was kind of an interesting way of him turning around and saying, yeah, I mean, we are so reactive. Right away, we got to do something. We love to do. Something happens, we do something, do something, do something, do something. And often our doing is totally unproductive. But it makes us feel what? What? Good? Yeah, like because we feel like we're doing something. Even though what we're doing is of no consequence at all. And sometimes our doing is only you know, making the problem worse. True? Right? I mean, we could have all run over there, couldn't we have? Right? Stood around. What are we going to do? What should we do? And prevented those who knew what they were doing from getting to the person. Right? So it is... I think it was a very, it was a, one of those teaching moments for all of us. Because this goes on all the time. In our lives, in other people's lives. It's a world of endless crisis. Right? And if people aren't in real crises, they're in emotional crises. And all the time, you know, there is this need within us to react. Monkey see, monkey do. Again, to come from a wise place, an intelligent place, a deep place, to really see clearly what the situation is and really have one wits about oneself, so when we do something, it's a doing that's really gonna make a difference. Sometimes we have to what? Stop. Now, obviously, in a situation like that, for us to stop, you know, for the medical professionals to stop and kind of, well, let me just, you know, practice my mindful meditation for a few minutes more, would have not been the most appropriate way to respond, right? And obviously, if something like this happened on the street or alone and we weren't medical professionals, we would go over there and do something, call 911. I mean, there is something to do, but it's very interesting. I mean, there was a situation there, happened, unexpected, immediately taken care of by the right people. And for the rest of us, what? There was nothing we needed to do. And yet that's hard for many of us. Look, what's going on? It's funny, when you enter a Zen training experience in a monastery or a Zen, something like that, and it's part of monastic training. Also, you learn to keep your eyes down. Very difficult for us. We're always what? Looking around. You know, so somebody walks in the hall, we're looking. Somebody's ringing the bell, we're looking. Right? We're always going out, and we wonder why inside we don't feel settled. Monkey mind. Anybody ever monkey mind? Anybody ever been around monkeys? What do monkeys do? What? They jump around. They react to everything. You know? If you're ever in the jungle or around monkeys, you know, all of a sudden there's a sound. All of a sudden, you know, they're all like monkeys. They're all very excitable. Hang around monkeys. You'll learn a lot. Yeah, they're very excitable and always looking. Jumping around and monkey see, monkey do. There's no intervention of any kind of awareness. And we have to see many of us are like that. We have minds like that. They're always going out. Thich Nhat Hanh says we need to learn to stay home. Many of us don't stay home because our home is not comfortable. Our body-mind is not a place of comfort, not a place of ease, right? It's like we lived in a house that we really didn't like, you know? So we always want to what? Go out. We don't like staying home. And many of us, that's the way it is with our own body-mind. We know we're not comfortable. It's not a safe, relaxed, wholesome place. So we're always looking out. And because we're always looking out, scanning the outside world, looking for problems, looking for situations to react to, looking for stimulations, we never take the time to get our own house in order. So we can have a nice home. And we can feel comfortable staying here. That takes, for many of us who are very externally driven, as we might say, it takes a willingness to put one's eyes down. Learn to walk around. Just being, we put our eyes down when we do walking meditation inside and when we're sitting. So we're not looking around. So we're learning to attend to our own body-mind. So today I want to share with you some teachings. And again, we have taught this text, studied this text. This is the third time. We have an intensive on this text. We just had a retreat dealing with the section, the chapter on patience. And we have a whole intensive going on, 70, 80 people involved in the study and practice of this text. Are there people here who are not familiar with the text? Probably many are, or not? Good, okay. So basically, in 2 seconds or less, what's happened up to now is this great master, Shantideva, has introduced us to our awakened mind. He's let us know we all have this Buddha mind. We all have this awakened mind, this mind that is beyond self. It's beyond conditioning. It is the source of all good. It is the source of all wisdom. It is the great ocean of peace and understanding. And it's our own mind, right? But we don't know it because we've been too busy pursuing. Like monkeys, we're just too busy out here. So he introduces us that we have this awakened mind, and he introduces us to that the most noble thing that one can do in life is to follow a path that leads to the realization and the awakening of this mind of ours. And he says, because it is the source of all good, it is also the end of all suffering. And not only do we have the capacity of ending our suffering by its realization, but most importantly, all the people we care about, all the people we love, and the whole world, we can end their suffering through this realization. We then would have the capacity of ending their sufferings completely. So he's introduced us to this mind of enlightenment, this path of enlightenment. He's really tried to do his best in these early chapters to sell us on it, and that not only is this an altruistic path, but he also says this is the path of happiness. This is the path of true happiness. You know, people who are awakened and people who follow this path of awakening—they're the real happy ones, because their happiness is coming from inside. So those are the first three chapters, and I mean, I've left something out. So having said that, the next three chapters are, okay, so what do I do now? You know, we have this awakened mind. I understand that beings are suffering everywhere, that this is the path of happiness, that this is the path to follow. Okay, what do I do? All right, so now we have chapters that are really kind of explaining the practices of a bodhisattva. So what I want to share a little bit from today, we'll see how far we get, is from chapter 5 called Vigilant Introspection. And he begins. Those who wish to keep the trainings must with perfect self-possession guard their minds. Without this guard upon their mind, these trainings cannot be preserved. Wandering where it will, the elephant of mind will bring us down to torment in the hell of unrelenting pain. No worldly beast, however wild and crazed, could bring upon us such calamities. If, with mindfulness's rope, the elephant of mind is tethered all around, our fears will come to nothing, every virtue drop into our hands. So these are the first three stanzas. Again, very clear. Those who wish to keep the training. So when he says trainings, you know, whatever it is that you've kind of made a commitment to train in, whatever that is, if you have made a commitment to be a certain kind of person, to train yourself in mindfulness, to train yourself in meditation, to train yourself in compassion, to train yourself in patience, to train yourself in not doing harm, train yourself in being a selfless person, less selfish, right? You know, whatever you've trained yourself, whatever you're trying to train yourself in, right? To be less impulsive, you know what I mean? Whatever it is, that you see, he calls them trainings, but what he's referring to is whatever each of us have made the commitment that we want to train ourselves in. Okay. Anybody ever kind of make commitment that they want to train themselves in something, but find it often they fall short of the mark? Yeah. Okay. So he understands that. That just having the wish or the commitment to train ourselves in something, it just doesn't happen by itself. This is a century. So he knows that he's known as the mind. He said those who wish to keep their trainings, who want to accomplish their goals in life, must with perfect self-possession guard their mind. Without this guard upon the mind, these trainings cannot be preserved. Very strong statement. Okay. If there are things you want to accomplish in this life, and here he's not talking about worldly things, he's talking about all these kind of spiritual values. If we want to maintain them and keep them so we realize their fruits, there must be a guard upon our mind. If there is no guard upon the mind, these trainings will not be realized. They'll not be practiced with any kind of consistency. Because he says, wandering where it will, the elephant of mind. Now, those of us who live in Tampa, the metaphor of the elephant of mind may go, we may not kind of get that. But if you lived in Asia, if you lived in India, an elephant is the biggest thing around, right? The elephant is the biggest thing around. And when an elephant goes trashing around in your fields and village, watch out, right? Because it is big, and it very easily can destroy, right? So when people hear the elephant of their mind, they know what he's talking about. Okay? It is something that untrained can wreak havoc. Now, obviously, if you've been to Asia or something, you know. People train elephants. Okay. But the wild elephant left to its own devices is very dangerous, can be very dangerous. Okay. So he's calling our minds the elephant of mind. So this elephant of mind, untrained, left to its own devices, going anywhere it has, he says, will bring us down in the torment of the hell of unrelenting pain. Again, this is kind of medieval times. Hell was kind of a metaphor that was very widely used. But we understand that psychologically, right? Our minds, wandering where they will, can clearly lead us into pain, emotional pain, into personal pain, conflict. It can lead the world into unremitting pain. And he then says, no worldly beast, however wild and crazed, could bring upon us such calamities. Right? Because even if if a wild elephant came through our village and kind of trashed our fields and trashed some of our houses, we could always what? Rebuild. Right? But this elephant of mind just continues. So he says, hey guys, I know you're very concerned about wild elephants, but there's a greater danger closer at hand. It is this wild elephant of our mind. Untrained, can wreak havoc. I mean, everybody understands this, right? I mean, this is not something we don't know, but something we don't reflect on. If with mindfulness's rope, the elephant of mind is tethered all around, our fears will come to nothing and every virtue drop into our hands. So here he's using, and we'll talk more about this a little bit, he's using mindfulness with the idea that it is a rope. Right? It is the way we grab hold of this wild beast, our own minds, right, and prevent it from running amok. It's not necessarily that we've tamed it yet, right? You see, it's not necessarily that we've trained it yet. But with mindfulness, at least we got a hold on it. Is that clear? Okay. This has got to be step one. If you're going to train the elephant, you have to what? You have to kind of have a rope on him. Is that clear? Right, if you're going to train your dog, what do you need? A leash. Try training your dog without a leash. Not easy, right? You got to have a leash on. Now, hopefully when he's trained or she's trained, you won't need the leash, right? They're trained. But when they're not trained, you need the leash. He says the leash is mindfulness. We got to be aware of this mind and what it's doing. There's got to be something that gives us the capacity, right, of bringing this elephant mind, this monkey mind, whatever you want to call it, this reactive mind, you know, somewhat under our control so it's not running amok. At this point, for many of us, our minds just run amok. Our emotions just run amok. Our reactivity just run amok. Our mind states just run amok. Our memories just run amok. Our emotionality just runs amok, right? Just all day long, right? What? Our thoughts running amok all day long. And we are what? We are what? We're just hanging on, right? Hoping we don't do too much damage this time. Right? Something ticks us off and we'll stay angry for hours and hours. We'll worry about things for days and days. We'll nurse our resentments. We'll nurse our hurts. We'll nurse our disappointments uncontrollably until eventually even we get sick of it. Right? We relax a bit, and then we start all over again. So he's pointing to something very essential that we often don't notice. These minds of ours are running amok. And if we want to achieve our goals in life, in this case our spiritual goals, to be the kind of person we want to be in life and how we want to show up, and be in relationships, et cetera, et cetera. You know, we need to understand. And he says, if with mindfulness rope this elephant mind is tethered all around, our fears will come to nothing and every virtue will drop into our hands. Well, that sounds good. I mean, that sounds easy. So for those of you who would like, you know, you're a little lazy, don't want to work too hard, right? Would like all your fears to just come to nothing and every virtue just like that drop in your hand. You have to work it. You're just going to choose a virtue. Just comes right, drops in our hand. Listen to what he's saying. But to do that, this elephant of mind needs to be roped. Doesn't need to be choked. Okay, let's get that straight. Doesn't need to be choked. doesn't need to be killed, doesn't need to be harmed, doesn't need to be abused, okay? But it needs to be what? Trained. And there are many, as we know, there are many good ways, very positive ways, that you can train an animal without in any way destroying its spirit, right? Or doing it harm. And there are ways of training that do that. But this is the former. For all anxiety and fear and pain in boundless quantity, their source and wellspring is the mind itself, as he who spoke the truth declared. He's referring to the Buddha. Again, short verses. Maybe you all get this, but this is very important. For all anxiety and fear and pain in boundless quantity. So when he says anxiety and fear, all emotional afflictions, all disturbing emotions, right? All painful emotions. Okay. Their source and wellspring is the mind itself. So this is radical. And this is fundamental. If we're going to proceed on this path, we have to be clear. I think we're talking about this at the wake-up last night. I met with the wake-up people. You know, all our emotions, all our thoughts, everything is arising where? In our mind. Nowhere else. Right? Anger, fear, sadness, despair, envy, you know, all those things do not reside in the object at all. We're just projecting that stuff onto the object, onto the person. Thoughts, feelings, perceptions, memories are events that arise in the mind. Whose mind? Well, each one of us has that. And when we understand that, we are on to something significant. As long as we think, and people say this all the time, well, of course, wouldn't you be angry? Wouldn't you be resentful? Wouldn't you be furious if this had happened to you? And my response is no. Wouldn't you be worried about this? You know? Wouldn't you be hurt if they did this? Right? We talk about these things as if all our emotionality is caused by external events in other people, and that we have no choice but to react in this afflictive way. I mean, we repeat this as truth. This is our dharma, isn't it? If we're honest. This is our dharma. The dharma of we are the victims of others. That's our American dharma. And if we could just straighten everybody else out, get them to shape up and act right, then what? I wouldn't be angry. I wouldn't be resentful. I wouldn't be hurt. I wouldn't be sad, right? Everybody know what I'm talking about? Good. So now we get to, again, this is, he'll be saying a different way, but very famous. Let me just drink a little tea. But again, please just don't kind of nod your head in agreement with me. This is radical. This is, I think, one of the hardest things for people who enter this path, especially Americans, again, I don't know about it, you know, to get that it's, you know, that it's, the cause is not out there. The cause is always in here. Because that's where it all arises. Your thoughts, your beliefs, your feelings, your memories, your perceptions are all mental events. They have no reality outside of that. That's the truth, isn't it? You know, we could run a scenario of justification in our mind, and you know what? Nobody cares. You know, 6 billion people on this planet, and nobody cares that you have justified whatever you're feeling have done to yourself. That whole, you know, and you can ruminate about this and that and go over some scenario for hours and years and days, and it, you know, it's like, it's all going on within you. It's not real. I mean, that's often very, you know, what? Yeah. You know, you can ruminate forever about your childhood and your hurts and your this and that and what happened and should have happened and didn't happen. And all that dialogue is going on where? In your own mind. It's not going on in reality. And that's wonderful to know. Because it means, once I know that, I know the healing and solution of that lies within my own mind. Because I'm the one who's harming myself. That experience that happened 20, 30, 10, 100 years ago is past. It doesn't exist anymore. It only exists as what? Memory within my own mind. It's my mind. I mean, can you see this is big? This is a radical shift in our just way we approach things. Harmful beings, and I'm skipping around a little bit. Harmful beings are everywhere like space itself. Impossible it is that all should be suppressed. But let this angry mind alone be overthrown. And it's as though all foes have been subdued. So harmful beings, we might say, you know, all the situations and all the people that aren't proceeding in life the way we like them. They're harming what? They're harming the way we'd like things to be. Right? They're everywhere. We can't suppress them all. Right? We get this one under control, now this one's acting out. Right? Is that clear? I mean, it's like endless. We, you know, and many of us have worked very diligently to try to suppress all these harmful people and situations, get them under control. But then he says, it's impossible. But let this angry mind, one thing, this angry mind alone be overthrown, and all the foes have been subdued. There's no longer harmful beings out there. There's no longer harmful situations. Because it's the way I perceive it that's a problem. And then this is the famous lines. Maybe you've heard this. But for many people, when they hear these lines, it's like they get it. He says, to cover all the earth with sheets of leather. Where could such amounts of skin be found? But with the leather soles of just my shoes, it is as though I cover the whole earth. Is that clear? Imagine the world, the whole world is just covered with thorns. Thorny bushes, right? The whole world. And you're barefoot. Try that one, okay? The whole world is just covered with this kind of low bush, like creepers, that have thorns. The whole world. And you're barefoot. And it hurts, right? It hurts to walk about, right? And you want a solution. You don't want to be walking around hurt all the time, your feet bleeding. So you come up with a plan. I'll just cover every thorn bush in the whole world, and then my feet, you know, won't bleed and won't get hurt. We laugh, and yet that's what we do. Right? You know, I will just get enough covering to cover the whole world, and then I can walk about barefoot. Because you know what? I like walking around barefoot. So I'll just cover the whole world. It's crazy, isn't it? And such hard work, with such limited results. But if I just got one decent pair of shoes, right, just to cover my own feet, I could walk anywhere. Right? Is that clear? You get the analogy. Forgive me for being, you know, this is big. You know, this is big. You know, which makes more sense? Which is easier? Please say it for me. Which is easier? Covering our shoes. One decent pair of shoes. Or cover the whole earth with leather. And yet, if we watched our minds all day long, our annoyances, our irritations, our angers, our resentments, I can't believe this, our worries, our anxieties, our despairs, our, you know, disappointment, are all because what? Because of the thorns of the world. That we are endlessly, endlessly, endlessly getting pricked by, and our solution is what? What's our solution? Come on. What? What's our solution? Well, that's, I'm going before we get that one. Our solution is what? Try to control and manipulate everything. Everybody, everything, the world, to make it the way I want it to be. Right? Then I will be happy. Okay? That's the deal. Right? When I get the whole world, not just the people close to me, okay? You know what I mean? But the whole world. All the governments, all the leaders, all the forces in the world, you know, I'm going to get them, when I get them all to do it the way I want them to do, then I will be happy and at peace, right? But until then, I'm going to stay agitated, worried, scared, angry, upset, despairing, and people will say what? Well, wouldn't you? My response is, of course not. Because I know what? That all those afflictive mind states are arising not out there, they're in my mind. And they actually disturb my mind and prevent me from seeing clearly and from acting wisely in the world. Which means other people. So this is very radical for many of us, if not most of us, if not all of us, to really understand that there is nothing going on out there that isn't the product of causes and conditions. Right? Why is the world the way it is? In Buddhism, we say, why? Causes and conditions. Why do we have global warming? Causes and conditions. Why do we have the governments we have? Causes and conditions. Why do we have everything good and bad in the world? Because of causes and conditions. Is that not true? Why am I the way I am? Causes and conditions. We are all the product, each of us, of causes and conditions. which means past. All the things that have happened to us in the past, all the forces, very personal, familial, cultural, you know, so many forces, this, all of us have been molded by these forces, as has everything in the world. Right? Why did somebody just do what they did? Because of causes and conditions. Why did that man pass out? Because of causes and conditions. Is that not true? And in response to causes and conditions, as was said earlier, it's simply what? Is there anything that I can do? Be helpful. Do you need a lot of emotionality for that? To respond in that very simple, direct, wise, compassionate way? Do I have to obsessively watch the news to understand the great suffering in this world? Right? Do I always have to be feeding my anger and my despair and, you know? Or can it be something that I generate from within? Is that clear? We don't realize how we are endlessly keeping ourselves in a state of arousal with afflictive emotions by our endless consumption of information. Which get us aroused, oftentimes our capacity to act is limited. Doesn't mean we don't act. Cover all the earth with sheets of leather, where could such amounts of skin be found? But with the leather soles of just my shoes, it is as though I cover all the earth. And thus the outer, this is like a century. I just want you to know, a century. India. And thus the outer course of things I cannot restrain. I myself cannot restrain. But let me just restrain my mind. And what is left to be restrained? How beautiful. It is this mind of mine that I need to tame, that I need to restrain, that I need to train. So it acts in a wise and healthy way in this world. Is that clear? And that's what this path is about. That's why we practice mindfulness and meditation and insight and patience and loving kindness and compassion. We are training the mind so it can act wisely and compassionately and intelligently in this world. And we are working to free ourselves by all this emotional reactivity that just keeps us disturbed. In Buddhism, the emotion, these afflictive emotions, they're called kleshas. Kleshas means covering. Right? So it's very descriptive. When we are in the throes of this emotionality, the natural intelligence and wisdom and compassion of the mind is covered. Right? We all know that. Anybody here ever been angry? I like that one. Because that's one we can all relate to. And he already been very angry. Okay. Have you ever acted in a way, said or done things that when you are not angry, you wouldn't have said or done? Does everybody nod? Well, why is that? Is it because you're a bad person? No. It's because your mind was covered, right, by this affliction, this klesha. And whether it's anger, resentment, or fear, and you know, worry, you know, despair, all these things are coverings. That's why, you know, we need to restrain them. Because when our mind is covered, you know, like somebody who has a good seeing, you know, 20/20 vision. But if somebody's covered your head with a cloth and says, go walk, what's going to happen? Put on a cover and you get in your car and start driving. What's going to happen? You see? What's going to happen? You're going to crash. Is it because you're a bad driver? No. It's because your eyes were covered. Right? See? We need to blame the right thing. Most of the time we blame what? Ourselves. The issue is not ourselves. The issue is these emotional afflictions and wrong thinking and mind states that are just covering us. And they don't allow us to see clearly. And thus the outer course of things I myself cannot restrain, and let me just restrain my mind, and what is there left to restrain? All those who fail to understand the secret of the mind, the greatest of all things, though they wish for joy and the end of sorrow, will wander to no purpose uselessly. Very interesting. Very strong statement. Let me read that again. All those who fail to understand the secret of the mind, the greatest of all things, though they wish for joy and the end of sorrow, will wander to no purpose uselessly. Therefore, I will take in hand and will protect this mind of mine. What use to me are many disciplines if I can't guard and discipline my mind? So, he calls the mind, this mind of ours, the greatest of all things. It is true. Because all of us experience everything in life with what? Through our minds. Right? Who's listening to me right now? Your mind is listening. Every thought you have, every feeling you have, every belief you had, is all arising because of this mind. It is the greatest treasure that human beings have. Isn't it? But the secret means we don't understand how it works. You see, those who fail to understand the secret of our minds, even though we have all the wishes for happiness and well-being and goodness for ourselves and others, or even though we want to end our suffering, end our sorrow, end our emotional afflictions, if we don't understand how our minds operate and understand where the problem is, all our efforts will come to naught. Doesn't matter. And then he goes on. Therefore, I'll take in hand and will protect this mind of mine. What use to me are the many disciplines if I can't guard and discipline my mind? So there it is. So for those of you who have undertaken all kinds of spiritual disciplines, read all kinds of spiritual books, heard all kinds of spiritual talks, engaged in all kinds of spiritual conversations, and if you wonder why it is, with all these years of reading and studying and practicing and da-da-da, I'm still driven by my afflictions, by my glaciers. It is because we have not guarded and disciplined the most essential thing, our minds. Again, it's not that we're bad people. It's not that we're inherently flawed. It's not that we're terrible practitioners. We just haven't gotten this fact. That even though we've engaged in all these various disciplines, a little here, a little there, read this, studied that, went to this retreat, went that. If we haven't, on an ongoing basis, been guarding our minds, right? making sure that the leather is on our own foot first. Right? It will come to naught. Useless, he says. We'll still wander because we'll never achieve that which we really desire, which we cannot achieve as long as we think it's, you know, it's all about out there, changing out there. There's a line in there in the chapter on generosity where Shanti Davis says, if poverty could just be alleviated by generous acts, he says, then wouldn't the Buddhas have done this eons ago? Very interesting. But he said the problem is that generosity has to come from a generous mind, not just from actions. Because actions may only take care of the problem in the moment, but the underlying lack of generosity, this desire to hold on, this desire to primarily give most of my generosity, let's say in terms of finances or whatever, to myself. And just give a little to others. Why is that? Why do we hold on? Why do we hold on to our things, our monies, our time, our energy? Because we don't have a generous mind. So we may engage in actions that appear to be generous, and they probably are in the short run. But what Shanti Davis says in that chapter on generosity, create first a generous mind. Then, in all the situations of life, you'll always act in a generous way. Because at the very mind itself, you've cut that strong belief that basically everything in my life is primarily for me. Therefore, I will take in hand and will protect this mind of mine. What use are there? What use to me are many disciplines if I can't guard and discipline my mind? Any questions before I just get to mindfulness and introspection? Anybody that's not sitting right with you or you have questions about this? I mean, this is kind of big stuff, unless you're all going, wow, this is easy. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, what I consider to be a wild man. Mm-hmm. And I feel it going through sort of phases. Where I feel less afraid than more affliction like will arise. But I've changed my perspective. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which is to sort of, I'm familiar with it, but now I'm starting to rest with it.
Right.
Be more restful with it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in that restfulness, I feel more of it dissipate.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's good. So, repeat the question. So the question is about affliction, in this case, the affliction of fear, and how Molly has been working with it, learning to be more at rest with it, and slowly she feels it is dissipating. And, you know, is there a time when it's totally dissipated? And how does one know that? Yeah, so the first important thing, let's say, just using that as an example, based on what Shanti Deva's teachings here. Most of the time when people are anxious and fearful, their response to it is what? Control the feared object, right? I used to work a lot with people with anxiety problems. That's always a response, right? I'm afraid of flying, so what do? Don't fly. Problem solved. Afraid of snakes, what do? Stay away from snakes. Problem solved, right? So traditionally, I'm afraid of being alone, so what do? Get people to stay with me all the time, right? See, in that way, we are always trying to control the external situation. Is that clear? Solve it. Rather than understanding, the fear is arising where? Within my own mind. There's the problem and there's a solution. The problem is not out there. So that's key, okay? To get that sense, this is my problem, it's arising in my mind, and I got to solve it here. Right? And the more that I am trying to manipulate my external environment to overcome that fear, I am just perpetuating that fear. See, it's kind of reversed. You see, we don't even know it. Okay? So, once we turn inward, right, like you're saying, and go, my fear, you understand the cause and conditions that have produced it, and now, you know, we need to work very diligently to retrain the mind so it doesn't give vent to fear because it's been conditioned to it. And again, I mean, there are many ways to do that. So if you're saying you're at a place where just learning to just be with it and let it just dissipate and calm is fine, you know. But the issue is when we're working with afflictive emotions is whether we're not, and this is the trick, right, whether we're not continuing them. You know, and that's tricky because we can be very mindfully holding on to them, but they are not, you know, and then slowly they dissipate, but then they come back again and they come back again. So we really want to make sure that we're working in a way that is, like you finally said, we should be free of them. Right? The Buddhist path is a path of the cessation of suffering. Why can it make such a claim that, you know, all suffering can cease? Because suffering arises because of causes. You know, it just doesn't arise without any cause. Right? Whatever emotional suffering we have in life, or the way we act or interact, it's because of causes and conditions in the past that we have developed this afflictive way of being in life, either in the actions of our mind, of our speech, or of our body. And when we change those causes and conditions, that, you know, as Shanti Deva says somewhere, you know, when a fire breaks out, you know, pull the straw away from it. Right? It'll burn itself out. Don't throw more straw. Okay? So we got to be very careful that when our emotional afflictions arise, that we're not throwing a little more gasoline on it, that we're not throwing straw on it. We're gonna, you know, like you're saying, you're pulling everything away, and so you're just kind of, you know, being there with that and just kind of watching it, because you're not feeding it, it will dissipate, and of course it will. Right? And over time, if you continue to do that, eventually, you know, it'll all go away. Why? Because it only has arisen in you, and you know your own story because of causes and conditions. When those causes and conditions change, and you're no longer nurturing those things that sustain the fear, as well as you're nurturing things that sustain confidence and trust, you know, it'll change. Yeah. Any other questions before we just... Yes. Yes. Definitely.
I think I understand that, you know, for you to be able to walk, you would put shoes on your own feet, but mm-hmm. that seems a little selfish to me.
Let's take one step at a time, Nancy. Okay? If you don't have shoes on, you can't go out there and help anybody else. Okay? So this is important, you know, and this is again, you know, and you know well, our Western, we are basically do-gooders, which is often good, you know what I mean? But that's our culture. We do good acts, you know, jump right out there and do something. And this is a little different. He's saying, you know, people are suffering. Do you know how to free yourself from your own suffering? Have you done that? Now you have really something to offer people. I mean, you know, Shantideva is wonderful. I encourage everybody. He says, you know, the world applauds people, praises people who take a damp cloth. Like right this morning, right? Somebody got who got a damp cloth to right? We go, wonderful, what a compassion, you know what I'm saying? And yet, that's just a temporary action. Right? Temporarily, that person's head that was in trouble has now been soothed. Right? But, and we'll just use as an example, maybe that passing out is the result of something much deeper. I don't know. I mean, maybe it wasn't. You know, maybe the person is diabetic, or, you know, who knows, or unhealthy, or has a heart condition, you see? How much more for the person that can help them with the cause of that, you see? And so we are very good at putting Band-Aids on problems. But to really see the cause of these problems is a very different way of looking at life. And the solutions that we come up with may be very different. Again, you know, if the world is full of thorns and you look out and you see everybody, you know, running around cutting up their feet and go, oh, look at all those poor suffering beings. Let me run out there. And immediately what happens? Your feet get cut up, right? So it's not a selfish action, you see. I mean, you were sort of saying, well, isn't it? It's if all you were going to do was, you know, well, now I got my shoes. Yeah, if all I got my shoes, no, that the Bodhisattva way is first you get your shoes, then you go out and help other people get their shoes. Right. So, yeah, I mean, actually, a lot of this Mahayana path, they rail against those kind of people who only want, you know, to liberate themselves, free themselves from suffering. This is nice. I'll just enjoy my life now. Right? No more thorns. I get a pair of shoes. Right? It's like living in a gated community. Everything's nice in here. Right? I used to live in Naples, Florida, so I know about gated communities. Right? It's that same way, right? The hell with the rest of the world. Everything in here is beautiful, and we're safe, and we get the guy at the gate. It's sort of the same thing. But, so this is not about that. This is an understanding. I got to get my own shoes on first so I can go out in the world and help other people. But if I don't have my own shoes, you know, I'll be bleeding. Before I know it, I'll get exhausted. I'll be stressed. I'll be this. I'll act. Any other questions? Yeah, I mean, this is life-changing stuff, you know? I mean, it's just words, and but it's life-changing. That's my experience. I mean, it's like if you really take it in, you go, wow, I never saw it that way, you know? It's so radical because he's coming at life and our situation in such an opposite way than we often do. Yeah, so he says, all you, that's us, all you who would protect your minds, maintain your mindfulness and introspection, guard them both at the cost of life and limb. I join my hands beseeching you. very powerful to me. He gives these instructions, and then he says, I join my hands beseeching you. Can you see? He's calling out from the 8th century. He said, I beseech you, right? Stop causing harm to yourself. Stop causing harm to others. Be a source of goodness in this life, right? You see? He's calling, he's beseeching us. Can you hear him? Shantideva, beseeching us, you know, calling us to a different life. So this chapter is called Vigilant Introspection. He gets very practical now, but we won't have time, but we have enough to talk about all you who protect your minds. Remember, it's what we've been kind of getting to, right? Guarding our minds, protecting our minds, keeping it from harm. Maintain your mindfulness and introspection. So let me just say, and we can practice this the rest of the day. So here he's using mindfulness in a way that is different than many of us know about mindfulness. For many of us, mindfulness just means what? Kind of living in the present moment, just being present. Mindfulness has other meanings. In the Sanskrit, it's called smriti. And it means not only this capacity to be present, but also equally means the capacity to remember, to recollect, to not forget. Like I'm mindful of something. So it has that meaning. So we have to understand that when he says, maintain your mindfulness and introspection, here he's talking about it in relationship to this path. And in this path, what are we restraining the mind from? We're restraining it from unwholesomeness, right? And what do we want to train it in? Wholesomeness, okay? Oftentimes it's called the training in what to accept and what to reject. You see, we often in our external life, we kind of do that, right? Yeah, I don't want to go there, right? I don't want to do that. Oh, but yeah, I want to do that. We are accepting and rejecting life all the time. People, situations, events, invitations, accept, reject. Is that clear? So it goes on all the time. You know, there are things to accept, there are things to reject. And each of us may have our own personal criteria for what we accept and what we reject, right? Is that clear? We're all very unique. But now he's talking about something that we don't do, you see? Again, this is radically different. He's saying all these things that arise in our mind, right? Thoughts, feelings, emotions, memories, right? Is there anybody there keeping guard and has a clear criteria about what to accept and what to reject? See, how many of us would say, oh yeah, I have that internal. So he's calling that, that's what he's calling mindfulness, to be mindful of what is to be accepted and rejected inside. Okay? Many of us may have good criteria outside. There may be many people in here who are good people. You know, we engage a lot in wholesome good actions. We really stay away from unwholesome, negative, afflictive actions. You know, we in our actions out here, we try to do good, right? You see, you know, when all of a sudden a bad impulse, an unwholesome impulse, we don't act on it. Does everybody know what I'm talking about? So oftentimes, and again, many people don't, even externally. Right? They just kind of wander about in life, and you go, I can't believe they're doing that, you know, or hanging out with those people. But, you know, many people just don't have even externally criteria. Okay, but hopefully, as we develop and mature, we get criteria, right? We know wholesome experiences, wholesome people, unwholesome one, good company, bad company. You know, we kind of learn how to accept and reject, right? But this is about our minds. And what he's saying in this chapter on vigilant introspection, and it gets developed, is we need that even more importantly inside, right? There needs to be this mindfulness, this self-awareness that we kind of tether the mind with, that we are aware of mind states, emotional states, thoughts, memories, what to accept means to allow into our mind, and what to reject. We need this capacity inwardly to know the wholesome from the unwholesome, what to accept and what to reject. So that's what he calls mindfulness, which is part of this vigilant introspection. The other piece, which is the introspective piece, is what we would call examination. So he also says, as a practice, we need to be examining our minds, our speech, the actions of our body all the time to again be aware. Is this action of my body, is this action of my speech, or is this action of my mind about the cultivation of that which is wholesome or about the cultivation of that which is unwholesome? We need to be examining all our actions to see, you know, am I cultivating something which should be rejected? Right? Am I rejecting something that should be accepted? So this is a very powerful, especially if people really want to change. And have wondered, well, why haven't I changed? I certainly want to change, and all these spiritual values, they mean great things to me. Why is it that I really haven't inwardly changed? And oftentimes, it's because of this. You know, we haven't had this vigilant introspection. We haven't had the internal technology of how to do that. That we have to have this mindfulness, that we are aware of what is to be accepted, rejected. You know, we got to have criteria. Many of us don't have inner criteria in terms of our thoughts, our emotions, our mind states. Is that clear? We, you know, whatever comes up, we indulge. Right? Anger comes up, come on in. Right? Fear comes up, come on in. Love comes up, come on in. Right? I mean, it's not this bad. You know what I mean? It's like whatever comes up, and we wonder why, you know, sometimes I'm happy, sometimes I'm unhappy, sometimes I'm loving, sometimes I'm totally selfish, you know, everybody know what I'm talking about. And you wonder, well, why is that? Well, because there's nobody, there's nobody at the gate in our mind, you know. Is that clear? It's not like there's anything wrong with us. It's just like there's no discrimination inside. There may be lots of discrimination outside. But there's nothing inside. And that's where the problem is, because that's really, again, in our mind, is the central player in our life. So we have to have this mindfulness of what to accept and reject, and then we just have to be kind of examining and watching our mind throughout the day and the actions of our speech and our body just to make sure that we are, you know, doing that. And the more we do that, and we make, you know, we're constantly troubleshooting and modifying throughout the day, we will find that change is not that difficult. But without that gatekeeper, you know, very difficult. Without that rope of mindfulness, holding on to that wild elephant while it's still wild, right? Without that leash on that dog, right? Next time you get a dog, try to train him without a leash. Not easy, especially if you're outdoors. Because that dog is going to what? Off. Who wants to learn how to sit? Who wants to learn how to stay? God, who wants to do something stupid like fetch it? But anyhow, you know, with a leash, we can train the dog. Once it's trained, we don't have to, you know, be so strong on the leash, right? Once we train, we can even give it more leash. We can extend it. Right? It's like having a child. When they're young and little, we have to be very protective. We have to keep them on a close leash. Why? Because they're untrained. They can just go off anywhere. Monkey see, monkey do. But hopefully when we raise our children or when they mature, there's less and less need for that kind of control, right? Because they have developed their own capacity to know what's wholesome from what's unwholesome, right? What's going to create positive results for me and what's going to create negative results for me, right? And we know that's a learning process for children, right? So we have to work with our minds in the same way. If we just let our mind, you know, it's like, I mean, what kind of parent are you if you just tell your child, you don't give them any values, no instruction, no emotional self-management, no control, and say, go out in the world. Yeah. See what happens. Maybe doing a disservice to that child. So again, we need to understand that this mind of ours is ours. Is that clear? You know, that's often a very sad moment for many of us, isn't it? We'd like somebody else to kind of be responsible for this mind of ours. You know, I understand that. Certainly would be nice to get somebody else to take control of this thing and bring it under control and, you know, make the changes in it, right? I think that's why people like medication so much these days. You know, it just kind of makes it all so much easier, I think. But, you know, unfortunately, it's us. You know, the Buddha, you know, with his students, you know, his great disciples, he said to them, he said, you know, I would love to be able to enlighten you. He said, I really do. You know, I see you're suffering. I see you're deluded. I'd love to enlighten you. I mean, there are quotes where he says this. He says, but, you know, I can't. You know, you have to enlighten yourselves. All I can do is show you the way. And all I can do is show you the way. Give you the teachings, give you the practices, support you, but you got to do it. And he said that, you know, regretfully. He said, I'd love to be able to do it for you. So that's, you know, here we are. So when you sit, meditation, what do you come face to face with? Exactly. You know, and that's when the transformation begins. Right? Are we willing to sit with this mind of ours as it is today, right? And begin the process of training? Is that clear? I mean, that's what we're doing. None of us have the mind that we would love to have. Right? But here it is. Right? Causes and conditions have brought us to this point. Now, with the tools of Dharma, mindfulness, meditation, I mean, all we're getting, we now have the tools to train. Right? Same way, if we get a puppy, there's lots of wisdom out there, right, in puppy training, isn't there? We don't have to make it up ourselves. Just get the book. Just get the training video. Huh? And just follow directions. And lo and behold, what? If we follow directions and we're consistent and all that, we will find that puppy will become what? Trained. I mean, it's so simple. But for those of us who think, I don't need the book. I don't need the training video. I can do it myself. Again, you may be able to. But if you do, you're probably doing things that are in the book. Right? So, again, we have the manuals, we have the technology. Are we willing to follow instructions? And the instructions today are what? What? Vigilant introspection. Watch the mind. Have criteria. What to accept, what to reject. What's wholesome, what's not wholesome. And have that gatekeeper. Have that self-awareness. Have that mindfulness. Have that observer, whatever you want to call it. Somebody's going to be watching. Right? Somebody's got to be at the gate. There's got to be a gatekeeper. If you have a gate but no gatekeeper, anybody can get in. Right? If you have a guardhouse but no guard, anybody could get in. I mean, good people could get in, but also people who want to do you harm. As we know, Shantideva, in an earlier chapter, he said, said about our afflictive emotions, we got to really begin to see that they are, you know, they want to do us harm. You know, when we let them in, they don't do good. When we let anger and resentment and fear and irritation and despair and all this stuff in, they just do harm to us. So we have to begin to see that. We need a gatekeeper. Anybody ever go to a gated community when you get to the gatehouse? They say what? What? Are you on the list? Right? What? Criteria. Is that clear? We need to have a part of us that's kinda has criteria. Afflictive emotion? No. You're not on the list for coming into my mind. Sorry. Mindfulness, concentration, insight, generosity, kindness. Come on in. You're on the list. Okay, so watch your minds today. Begin to feel what it's like to have vigilant introspection. And again, you can be, you know, we're going to be eating, we're going to be resting, we're going to be doing mindful movements, we're going to have guided meditations. You know, whatever you're doing, you're doing, but you're all, part of you is just watching your mind, examining, and really see, do you have criteria? I mean, that's the first, right? Do I have criteria? Or is the gate always open? Open house at Fred's. When I was raising my children, you know, it'd be a big problem, right? Parents would go out of town or something, and kids would have what? Open houses. Could be a disaster, couldn't it? Everybody's invited. Okay? So we've got to be careful. We don't want open house in our own minds. So good. Are there any announcements? Yeah. So we'll stop here.